This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2020. From Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how Jacqueline Novogratz left a career in investment banking to try and change the world of philanthropy.
It was only when I was sitting on the plane that I thought, what have I done? I don't even know where I'm going. I don't know a soul. I don't have any money. And here goes.
Jacqueline Novogratz and the story of Acumen coming up next. Many years ago, when Jacqueline Novogratz was working for an NGO in Kigali, Rwanda, she spotted a boy wearing a blue sweater. It was strange because the sweater seemed very familiar to her. And the more she looked, the more she realized that it was actually her sweater, a sweater she had donated to Goodwill a decade earlier. Jacqueline had a kind of epiphany moment where she realized the interconnectedness of the world and her own potential to make an impact in someone's life. Today, Jacqueline is the co-founder and CEO of Acumen. It's a nonprofit that raises money from donors who are actually called investors to finance social enterprises around the world. Acumen has delivered more than $100 million in loans, grants, and investments in things like medical clinics, solar energy projects, and businesses that help low-income people around the world. Jacqueline applies the principles and ideas she learned as a young investment banker, not to make a massive profit, but to help empower communities to grow and thrive. Jacqueline grew up in a pretty large household. She was one of seven kids, the daughter of a military officer who served three tours of duty in Vietnam. And as a young girl, she was particularly inspired by the stories of women saints.
Those were the only stories that we read that were essentially the narratives of women who directed their own lives. They were also the first examples for me of people who lived and in some cases were willing to die for an idea. So I don't know if I thought of it in terms of, you know, I want to change the rules of capitalism, but I definitely wanted to do good and to be of use from a very young age.
What did your parents expect out of you? You know, when you were a student and you eventually were ready to leave home and go to college, what did they expect you to do and to become?
You know, when you grow up as one of seven, particularly as the eldest, I think what you integrate into yourself is more that sense of responsibility for the tribe. My parents had a great expectation that we would take care of ourselves at some level and, importantly, take care of others and contribute somehow to the world. So it was quite vague in terms of dreams. I was of that generation where parents didn't dictate where you would go to school or even how you would get into school, but rather independence. When I got into university, I actually wanted to be an English major. And that was when my father intervened and said, you know, you're never going to be able to support yourself as an English major. Maybe you should be an economics major, which I was not at all interested in. But I compromised and I went to foreign affairs and economics and took every English class I could, whether for credit or not. So I was, I think it was more driven by my parents to make sure I could provide for myself and for the world.
When you graduated from college from the University of Virginia, you went to a job interview at Chase Bank. And apparently the person interviewing you said, why do you want to be a banker? And you said, because my parents really have forced me to apply for this job. Is that true? Did your parents kind of push you to go work for a bank?
Yeah. And again, my parents didn't, they didn't force us to do anything, but they were and still are an incredibly powerful, I would say, moral force in our lives. And so we were always cutting deals. You know, I paid my way through school and I was fiercely independent and yet also, I guess, a dutiful child. And so the deal we cut when I announced to them with a lot of certainty that I was going to take a year off after school because I had worked so hard through university, they said, well, that's a great idea. However, we think it would be good experience for you.
Yeah.
And then as a kid who couldn't afford to travel, but always yearned to know the world, it was in that interview where the guy was like, well, that's too bad if you don't want to be a banker, because you know, this job, you'd be in 40 countries in the next 3 years.
You became a banker and spent 3 years, in fact, doing that and traveling around the world. And now when you look back at that, it's hard to believe that you were a banker knowing what I know about you and what's happened to you in your life. But I mean, working for Chase, you know, a classic New York bank, I mean, it must have given you a really important foundation for what you would eventually do with your life.
It was extraordinary. I always liked numbers. And yet, I never understood how numbers could really tell a story. And suddenly, by understanding financial statements of companies, or in some cases, entire portfolios for countries, I could see where priorities lie. I could see what the financial health of an entity was. And I could start to understand that if you really wanted to build something, you had to be able to cover the costs of what it would entail. And so suddenly I found this superpower that I loved. I didn't love, of course, how that superpower was only afforded to those who had access to the banks. And since I was spending so much of my time at that point in Latin America during a financial crisis, it was acute, the difference between the elites that had access to financial services and the rest of the country in places like Brazil, Argentina, Chile, who wouldn't even walk into the doors of the banks.
Is that what led you to leave? I mean, 1986, you leave Chase to go work in the nonprofit sector. Basically, I mean, you're a really young woman at this point. You're probably 25, and you're probably making really great money at Chase. But what was the thing that just got you to say, you know what, I'm done with this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah, and my first impulse was not to leave the private sector. As I said, I really loved the culture and the life was extraordinary. Being in a different country every month for somebody that was 25 years old, I actually proposed to my boss that I create a program for low-income people within the bank. And it was in a conversation with him at that moment when it was very clear to me that if I stayed, I was never going to explore this other set of possibilities. And then it got compounded, Guy, when the COO of the whole bank kind of plucked me out and said, you know, we have this real career for you here at Chase. And suddenly the stakes got very, very high because I knew then if I took this job with him, I probably would never leave.
Yeah.
And so I had to go.
A lot of people at that phase in life would not do that, or they might not know to do that.
I've always felt, and I actually feel that all of us have inside of us a bull and a dove. My bull and my dove just tend to be more prominent inside of me. And so there was this such a deep desire to know the world and to be an adventurer. And so I didn't think twice. I was quite cavalier, in fact, when I took the elevator up to the 60th floor to announce to the COO of Chase that I was going to move to Africa. And he was like, are you kidding me? You know, do you understand what you're giving up? And even then I didn't fully understand it. It was only when I was sitting on the plane listening to Joni Mitchell's Blue album that I thought, what have I done? I don't even know where I'm going. I don't know a soul. I don't have any money. And here goes.
So you went.
So I went.
And your first assignment will turn out to be kind of a
disaster.
Kind of a disaster, right? But a disaster that in retrospect maybe had to happen, right? And I guess you were working for a nonprofit organization. So when you got to the Ivory Coast, I guess you were really there to to kind of help develop the local economy, right? To like start giving loans to small businesses there in partnership with the local bank. Is that like what was your official job?
I was officially supposed to be an ambassador to help women set up these microfinance entities. Microfinance being tiny loans to low-income women so that they could start tiny businesses. And here I was, 25 years old, with 3 whole years of banking under my belt, thinking that I was going to save the world. And I had to confront very quickly and very painfully that most people don't want to be saved, particularly not by, you know, young people who had no understanding of the culture, very little facility with the language, and hadn't even been properly introduced in a way that anybody fully understood why I was there. And so it was a deep dive into making every mistake that one could make in development. But it happened so quickly that it was almost a gift, as you say, in that way.
How long did you stay in Cote d'Ivoire?
Less than 6 months. I also didn't understand then all the other layers of power within an existing status quo. I think too often we idealize people or we victimize people. And in a way, I had done both. I had both victimized the poor who needed help, and I had idealized some of the elites who wanted my job. And so I wasn't really seeing anybody as fully human with all their flaws and all of their perfections, including myself. I had to really reevaluate what it meant to recognize I was a guest, meet every person, you know, fully for who they were, and present a truer version of myself, that I was there to learn, not to quote unquote help. And that changed everything.
When you kind of left after just a series of bad experiences there, did you think that that was some sort of that was it? You were kind of done?
Oh no. Oh no. Because the stakes were so high, because I had told this man Tony Triciano that, you know, I'm going to Africa, not taking your big fancy career.
This was the COO at Chase.
Yeah. There was no possible way I was going back a complete failure. And so I moved to East Africa.
This is in Rwanda?
No, this is in Kenya.
In Kenya.
With another opportunity where I failed again. I had another big failure of, again, confronting what the status, we talk all the time, and young people talk all the time about rejecting the status quo.
Yeah.
But when we think of the status quo, we so often somehow think of these big, immovable systems, rather than the everyday realities that are around us. Sometimes the status quo are our parents, you know, our local religious leaders, our local civic leaders, very small institutions, big institutions. You know, people don't like change. And so here I was in this little institution that was fledgling and in trouble. And I thought by naming the problem, we would clearly be much better able to solve it. But that was not appreciated. And that's when I moved to Rwanda. I met a woman who invited me in because women had, for the first time in history, now we're in 1986, gotten access to open a bank account for the first time in history without their husband's signature.
So you get to Rwanda. This is an opportunity for women to be able to take out loans, which was in 1986, 87. This was revolutionary. Women until that point were not able to take out loans to start businesses.
No, they were under Napoleonic Code until 1986. They were put in the same category as the mentally incapable. And it was also the time the country had elected its first 3 women parliamentarians, who were 3 of my co-founders. You know, all run, owned, managed by Rwandan women.
And together you built this microfinance institution. And what did you, I mean, initially, was that model making microloans and you know, sort of a timetable for repayments? Was that the initial model, or was it just a grant of money for women entrepreneurs?
So we would make these $30 loans at very low interest to incredibly poor women. The average income at the time was about $112 a year. And yet I was undaunted by those low income levels. And it was really important to me that the women owned this, that it was theirs. And that included asking even poor women to contribute to the bank, which I look back now was, it was a radical move, but it was also crazy. And yet people did. They would bring just a few Rwandan francs and and they would contribute to it.
Were there women who were, you know, who were accepting the loans and kind of, I don't know, I mean, they were getting loans from these, you know, this microfinance bank that was backed by, you know, big Western donors. I mean, did any of them say, were any of them sort of puzzled about the repayment system? I mean, in other words, did any of them say, well, why would it matter? I mean, these big, you know, Western countries or donors aren't going to care about a $500 loan or $200 loan.
Yes, there were a number of our borrowers who assumed that we weren't individuals. And so ironically, while they might pay 10% per day to the local money lender who they knew and had a personal relationship with, they would default on our 12% per year loan. And when I would be, you know, crushed and feeling betrayed that we weren't being taken as seriously, the explanation, which came only after a couple of years of being there, was exactly what you say, Guy, that we don't know the money that's behind this, whereas we need the people in our community. And so I started to understand at a deeper level as well the kind of entanglement within community and the risk of both under-empathy and, frankly, over-empathy. And so when we could hold this tension between generosity and accountability, that's when we started to cook with gas and everybody started to understand the rules and feel really proud to be part of the organization. But we had to do a lot more capability building, both among our team and among the women in the markets, so that they could not only have access to financial services, but they could make use of the access, make use of the opportunity, and begin to thrive. And I think that's so often what we miss today when we look at poverty and we say, well, you know, everyone has an opportunity, but that's not enough. We have to also build capability to make use of opportunity.
Hmm. When you, I mean, you went on to business school, you came back to the U.S. and went to business school, and presumably you went to business school thinking, okay, I'm going to get an MBA and I'm going to try to figure out how I can make a contribution in this way and not in a finance job or something like that.
Yeah. It was very clear when I went to business school that I wanted to increase my own understanding of how business worked and the tools of management and finance so that whether I was going to build a bank in the United States or continue to focus globally on how you could use the tools of business to empower poor people to make their own decisions, which is what I actually think is at the root of dignity.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. Welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. How did you begin to develop the idea for what you wanted Acumen to be?
I would say I actually apprenticed for about 15 years, which for young people, it sounds like a forever amount of time, right? But I never knew that I was apprenticing. You know, each new adventure was essentially putting more tools into my toolbox, from Chase to Rwanda. Accidentally, I met Peter Goldmark, who was at the time the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. And he had created this fellowship for just six people, where he would allow those individuals to essentially do whatever we wanted to do for a year. And I was one of the selected fellows. So I spent a year really understanding at the time new financing methods that were really focused on how do you help low-income communities build assets and not just income. And that fundamentally changed me that year, that we could actually recreate business in a way that actually included low-income people. And it was a fantastic year. That then sent me on a series of other entrepreneurial ventures in the social sectors that were not a direct line into Acumen, first starting because of Peter Goldmark again, the president, kept challenging me. When I would see something that I really disliked along the way, he would say, okay, go fix it. So I really disliked philanthropy in that it seemed to me that too many people with a lot of wealth were focused on being loved themselves rather than using their money to make fundamental change. Yeah. And he said, well, you know, then I challenge you to start an organization that would train a new generation of philanthropists to be much more strategic about how they use their private capital to solve public problems.
And so I guess it's at this point that you started something called Philanthropy Workshop. And this is like the early 90s. And in the U.S., I think it was around the time of like the Rodney King beatings and the uprisings in Los Angeles. And despite the fact that your expertise really was like an investment banking and philanthropy, I guess that event sort of made you look towards America and towards some of the problems in this country. Did you feel like this was, did you feel prepared for that challenge?
I felt completely unqualified. White. I didn't see myself as privileged, and that was part of the learning of that experience.
Yeah.
That I was, for goodness sakes, with an MBA and a Rockefeller Foundation pedigree. But I knew that I could bring these skills that would be more empowering that I was seeing in the traditional charitable sector and where business was too often overlooking low-income people or seeing them as inputs rather than as full human beings that were, you know, deliberately trying to give them real opportunity. And so after that 15-year apprenticeship, I thought, what have I learned about how capital works and about what capital is even? That somehow along the way, the world divided it, this idea of money, into these almost arbitrary buckets that we have financial capital, and seemingly the only purpose, at least by the end of the 1990s, was to make more money. And then we have philanthropic capital, which was to, you know, just give it away. And both seem to be suboptimal. And so if you were to start over and look at a spectrum of capital money, how would you structure an investing approach that was very, very much focused on enabling poor people to solve their problems? What would that look like? That was the beginning for me. That was the big question I wanted to answer. And so it all came together with Acumen.
You decided to make this a nonprofit rather than a for-profit. I mean, because, you know, there were already social enterprises out there, and there are today. You know, there are Ben and Jerry's and the Body Shops of the world. They were for-profits, but they had a social mission. But you decided from the beginning, right, to make Acumen a nonprofit. Was there any pressure, or did people say, look, it's not going to work that way? There has to be, you know, a market-based solution, and that's how you get people, incentivize people to work hard and to, you know, so people can recoup their investments and so on and so forth. Were those conversations part of that early journey?
Almost everybody thought I should set it up as a for-profit. I can't tell you how many people would patiently explain to me that I obviously didn't know how business operated. I raise my money here, I give it away there. And we were much more, I would say, radical when we started, in that Acumen was registered as a nonprofit, but we had the capability of making long-term equity investments, or, you know, buying shares in companies, or making long-term loans or grants, but that we could be judicious in finding the right entrepreneurs that were trying to solve these big problems of healthcare, education. But to me, again, thinking about what is capital, we need the flexibility of a different kind of capital. We need to be able to take bets on those people crazy enough in the best way to try things, fail, try again. But if they do it and they find a way to build a self-sustaining mechanism, maybe we'll do a better job at solving problems and using that philanthropy in a way that actually changes things rather than makes us feel good.
The loans, Jacqueline, that you give out, that Acumen gives out, they aren't insignificant, right? I mean, the whole point is that this isn't like traditional charity. I mean, you're really managing investments and businesses and companies that provide services to low-income people. And I mean, we're talking about investments of like $500,000 or Is that kind of the average loan or investment?
Yeah, the average is probably we probably invest between $250,000 to $1 million. So these are companies that have, for the most part, have proven something.
Mm. And they're all focused on education, healthcare, agriculture, or clean energy. Those are sort of the buckets that you mm-hmm. focus on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline, as you have, I mean, it's been 20 years, you've invested $120+ million in countries around the world, Africa and Latin America and Southeast Asia and the U.S. And I mean, the story of Acumen has been such a success. But I'm wondering, over the past 20 years, clearly you have also seen the impact of capitalism and shareholder profit at all costs on in many of these countries. And clearly it has had an influence on your thinking, because you've written a book calling for a moral revolution. First of all, why do you think we need to have a moral revolution right now?
I wrote the book before COVID, but COVID in and of itself exposed the gaping wounds of what unbridled capitalism and technology, frankly, that these two forces also have within them the potential to destroy us. They've left us so unequal. They've left us with broken healthcare systems, broken food systems, broken criminal justice systems. All these systems are entangled. And so every one of our institutions needs a moral rejuvenation that moves from being driven by a success based on money, power, and fame. And certainly profit is at the center of all three of those, to one that dares to put our shared humanity and the sustainability of the earth at the center. So it's not a moral revolution of righteousness, you know, my right over your right, nor is it, you know, a set of rules prescribed from above, but it's a moral revolution that dares to flip the system, if you will, and insists on a definition of success that looks at how the poor and the vulnerable are treated, not just creates a world where the wealthy can thrive.
It's sort of the book kind of reads as a almost like a leadership guide for people to think about how to operate any kind of business, really. And I want to kind of touch on some of the ideas that you talk about in the book. One of them is you call for people to cultivate a moral imagination. So what do you mean by that?
Moral imagination starts by putting ourselves in other people's experiences, even if we know we can't fully feel them. We have the courage to see those people, that person inside ourselves and us in them as equals, which means, you know, as I inferred before, neither idealizing nor victimizing them. Moral imagination also then I see as a muscle. It's very active. It requires immersing in the lives of others, getting close, understanding problems, including structures that get in their way, but being honest as well about where people might get in their own way, and then acting. And so it's almost a four-part process. But the basis of that moral imagination is to build from the perspective of others and not just ourselves.
Do you think, Jacqueline, I mean, this is a sort of a weird moment, right? Because we're in the middle of this pandemic, and which has brought obviously a health crisis and an economic crisis, and there's also a social justice reawakening in the United States that has really kind of revealed a 400-year-old crisis, certainly in the United States and in many Western countries, when it comes to social justice and inequality. And it seems to me that so many of these conversations is around capitalism and around where capitalism is today. This is sort of the model that we've all kind of settled on. And for decades, we've heard that the capitalist system is the greatest generator of wealth. It lifts people out of poverty. And of course, a lot of it's true. But it's a problematic model, too. And I wonder if you have started to think about capitalism as a model that probably needs to be
fully reimagined. I think that the risk of deciding that there's no place for capitalism whatsoever is that we throw out the good as well as the bad. And that another one of the principles in the books is holding opposing truths without rejecting either. And that the answer to the conundrum of capitalism lies in holding this uncomfortable tension as well. I do think that there's a freedom and an innovation that comes from being able to have choice in our individual lives, but it can't come at the cost of the community.
I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. We'll be right back. This is Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. What would a capitalist system that is more humane and equitable look like? How would we start to think about creating that?
It would require us to not only acknowledge, but quantify and build narrative around how our employees are treated, how the environment is treated. We would reduce the value of companies that are actually hurting the environment. We would increase the value of companies that were going out of their way to hire people from vulnerable communities, people who required additional training. And we would also look at our responsibility to the consumers. And that would be the new story we would start to tell, so that we could lift the business models and the role models based on the amount of human energy they're releasing into the world, the amount of good we're contributing to society, rather than simply the amount of money that we were making. If we really put our moral imagination into action, we have the models, we have the technology and the skills. What we've got to do is, this is that idea of the moral revolution. What is our responsibility to each other? Capitalism cannot exist in a vacuum without the guardrails of what a good society needs. But we need a new conversation.
What do you think, Jacqueline, that you've learned over the years? And I have a hunch that part of it is based on your experiences, your early experiences in Africa. What is the secret superpower leader needs to have and learn in order to be effective?
The superpower is listening. All of our leaders are shouting at each other. The superpower is listening not from a place of certainty, but of inquiry. If we took the time to listen to each other, we would find the solutions. Because all of the problems that we get into are human problems, and we can get out of them. You know, Guy, we went back to those early years in Africa and where I had started this microfinance bank with the Rwandan women. And then a few years later, the genocide ripped apart the entire country. And I saw a country in complete ruins. I also had to confront the fact that the women who I loved and worked with played out every role of the genocide, including being perpetrators. And so I went back to visit with those women. Going back to Rwanda taught me that sometimes listening itself can be not just an act of hope, but an act of love. And I would sit there sometimes 3, 6, 10 hours, and I'd listen to the stories of survivors on both sides, perpetrators and those who had lost everyone in their family. And I would see the impact on the people of just being listened to, but also the insights that I would gain. And so may this, in this time of Black Lives Matter and our crisis of social injustice and health calamity and economic dislocation, you know, would it be that all of us listen a lot harder, particularly given that we are making big decisions as a nation? It's in our darkest times that we can sometimes find our best selves. But then we really have to fight those urges to give in to the easier path of the blaming, the shaming, and get to work of reimagining and rebuilding. And I think that's been what's driven my life and where I've been so inspired to see a country in ruins rebuild itself. And so if they can do it, we can do it.
Mm-hmm. It's listening. It's the single most important thing to start.
It is. Yeah. It is to start. And then I would say, then it's also because I think I had to learn the hard way that it's then knowing when to stop listening and just go lead.
Yeah.
Because I'm such a listener that then I would hear another input, another input, another input. And then it's like, okay, done, enough. And, you know, that same over empathy, under empathy, a lot of people will say, well, the community knows everything. And I used to kind of buy that. And like, that is such an unfair approach. Yeah. Maybe you could actually bring in some of what you know too, not in an arrogant way, but like sometimes the community is wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the humanity part too, and the humor part. But one thing we didn't talk about, Guy, is that, you know, COVID has accelerated all of the changes that we started to see in the last 10 years. I'm watching a lot of our entrepreneurs make radical decisions on the spot because they can now.
Yeah.
A number of our companies have gone from a tech platform to a partnership with government to ensure that everybody gets access to healthcare. You know, boom, 10 days.
Yeah.
It happens. And so that, I feel, is also a harbinger of good news, because the future requires that our corporations, our governments, our civil society, our private companies all need to change. And they all need to put purpose first and people first, as well as the planet. And that should drive our policy. That should drive the way that we construct our companies. That should drive the way we teach our students in business schools, so that we focus on character and not just on the content, which we've somehow satisfied ourselves was enough. And so I go back and forth in that way. I am not an apologist for unbridled capitalism. I think I've always thought it's a cruel system. And given that I've worked with communities that experience it at its cruelest, I could write a book just about that.
Yeah.
And yet I've also seen the power that comes when people do have access to markets in the best of ways as a form of freedom, Guy. And that matters.
That's Jacqueline Novogratz. She's the founder and CEO of Acumen, as well as the author of the book Manifesto for a Moral Revolution: Practices to Build a Better World. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.